This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given.
My name is Elvin Bethea. S-B-E-T-H-E-A. I played with the Houston Oilers for 16 years.
Bethea was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2003. He's now 72 years old, and he's doing all right.
I mean, I know I hope I'm normal, but I think I have all of my faculties together.
Bethea knows that many other former players aren't so fortunate. Only a Game's Martin Kessler picks up the story from here.
Elvin Bethea told me about a phone call he had. It was with a friend who'd played pro football before him.
We talked about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and after we hung up, phone rang about 2 or 3 minutes later. I'm sorry. I answered the phone. She said, and the person on the other end, the lady said, "Who is this?" And so I told her who it was. She says, Joe didn't know who he was talking to right then. And that hurt.
Most sports fans probably know that many former NFL players are struggling physically and mentally. But what they might not know is that many older NFL alums have financial problems, too.
And think about the little pension that we get. I call it a little pension compared to others. That money comes in and goes right out for doctor bills, for co-pays, for medicines.
Bethea, a Hall of Famer who, again, played 16 seasons with the Houston Oilers, says he receives $3,300 a month from the league. That comes to about $40,000 a year. But he'd be getting more if one thing were different about his career, the year he retired. Bethea and other players who retired before 1993 are not eligible for a range of benefits available to players who retired after 1993, and their pensions are about a third the size of current players.
We're the ones that built this, and we're forgotten.
Bethea is trying to change that. He's part of a new group that's calling for equitable pensions for pre-93 retirees. There's about 4,000 of them who qualify.
They're basically saying, look, give us the honor of pension parity before we all disappear.
That's Ken Belson, who covers the NFL for the New York Times. As he has reported, about 140 pre-93 retirees are dying every year. Belson says the roots of this pre-93, post-93 divide go back to the 70s. Football was overtaking baseball as the most popular sport in the U.S., and in the late 80s, serious labor strife began.
I think the players realized that, hey, wait a second, we want a bigger share of the pie.
The players wanted full free agency. That would mean bigger salaries because teams would have to bid for them in a free market. Not surprisingly, the owners resisted. For 5 years, the two sides failed to sign a labor deal. Finally, in 1993, they came to an agreement.
The players got a full version of free agency. In return, there was a salary cap put in as a sort of stopgap on runaway spending.
And the players received something else.
A whole host of generous benefits were put in, annuities, 401ks, enhanced severance, more years of health care coverage for retirees.
But these new benefits would not be available to players who had already retired. The agreement, Belson says, effectively put the pre-93 retirees in a different class.
Number one, they didn't play with full free agency, so they didn't make nearly the amount of money some of the current players were making. But they also were left with relatively small pensions and none of the other fringe benefits that the new players were getting.
And in the years after 1993, Belson says the gap between the two groups only widened.
You know, look, if your pension benefit is set at $250 for every year you played and there's no cost of living increase, it diminishes over time with inflation. That's just a fact.
For years, pre-93 retirees and others have been speaking out.
I have been advocating casually probably since about 2002.
That's Jane Arnett. Her husband John is a former NFL player. Arnett says she realized there was a real problem when Hall of Famer Dick Nitrane Lane passed away.
And there was no money to bury him. There was talk of him having a pauper's funeral, which, you know, unfortunately happens to a lot of people, but it was shocking that it would happen to a man like that.
Arnett says people did eventually step in to help cover the funeral costs, but the situation raised red flags.
I started asking around to other people what was going on, and suddenly there was an eruption of stories, similar stories.
Arnett says she came to learn there was a program available to help NFL alums in emergencies, a dire need fund. She says it was a wonderful resource for men who were struggling to pay their rent, mortgage, or medical bills.
And I think the thing that shocked me and really woke me up was one entry that was for a pair of eyeglasses. I realized, and we all realize, that there are many, many people in this world that are in that kind of a situation. It's not uncommon. What concerned me was, to me, this was family, and that someone would reach the point in his life that he couldn't even afford the $219 for his eyeglasses.
Arnett says that made her and other advocates think that more should be done to help retirees before they reach that level of desperation.
But we really came to the conclusion as a group that perhaps an increase of pensions would make sense.
Arnett says they tried to reach out to the Players Association.
We were met with some great hostility. We were really treated as if we were just troublemakers, we advocates.
In 2006, former NFL Players Association head Gene Upshaw was asked why retiree benefits were so low on the list of the union's priorities. Here's the New York Times' Ken Belson again.
He basically said, they don't hire me and they can't fire me. Speaking of retired players, they can complain about me all day long. They can have their opinion, but the active players have the vote. That's who pays my salary.
For the record, Upshaw, who died in 2008, said the quote was taken out of context. In 2011, the Players Association, under new head Demoris Smith, managed to secure a pension increase for pre-93 players.
And that was certainly welcome, but it's an extra 20, 30, 40%, depending on the player, off a very small number. You know, they're still one-third the amount that the current players are getting.
So I think a lot of our listeners will just have the gut reaction, you know, the NFL makes so much money, why can't the owners just pony up and give these 4,000 pre-93 retirees the same pension benefits?
The owners didn't build the league into a $14 billion business by giving things away.
The current collective bargaining agreement expires in 2021. If pre-93 retirees don't get equal pensions this time around, there may not be many left to help when the next deal comes up. So pre-93 retirees are taking one more shot, and going through the owners isn't their primary strategy. Before we get to that strategy, I want to tell you about the person leading this new effort. She's a lawyer with a pretty strong connection to the pre-93 retirees.
So I am Lisa Marie Riggins, and in addition to being an attorney, I happen to be married to a former NFL player, John Riggins.
Yeah, I feel like I've already been introduced, but I'm John Riggins. I'm an ex-football player. I grew up in Northeast Kansas.
John played running back in the NFL from 1971 to 1985. He was the MVP of Super Bowl XVII and was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1992.
Now that I'm an ex-football player, I'm actually doing what I do best. I become a ne'er-do-well.
What does that entail? What are the job
descriptions? I'm actually a little bit more than that. I'm the camp cook. I'm kind of the overseer of everything domestic in the house. And I'm also the landscape guy. If we had a pool, I'd be the pool boy.
For the record, John also works in broadcasting. John and Lisa Marie got married in 1996. A little over a decade later, they moved to Washington, D.C., where John had finished his playing career. Lisa Marie started meeting more former players. She realized many were in, quote, untenable situations. Then in October 2015, Lisa Marie was on a late-night flight home from California. She happened to be sitting next to a woman who worked in government. They started talking about the NFL concussion settlement.
And then segued into the pensions, because people always assume, well, you know, at least they can, you know, at least they have a good pension, or at least, you know, and it's like, no, 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 no. And then you start to explain it, and she, for her, it was shock.
Lisa Marie says she explained that the pre-93 retirees didn't have a legal option to try to improve their pensions. And that's when her seatmate gave her some advice.
And she said, you know, when the courts don't work, you got to go through a different door. So you need to get into the court of public opinion and really mine that ore.
Lisa Marie says this was a turning point. She decided she had to get the story of the pre-93 retirees out to the public. She started trying to set up meetings with lobbyists and other people around D.C.
people met with me solely because of my last name. So I had this currency that I felt like I needed to use.
Finally, Lisa Marie Riggins realized she needed to have a conversation with the general partner at her new law firm, where she'd been given the corner office. She explained that she needed some time to focus on the issue.
And I said, I think it's going to take me about 6 months. So I need to just back off any cases and just take whatever I can take.
Lisa Marie started laying the groundwork to launch a public advocacy campaign. She started working to form a 501c3. She retained a lobbying firm to do research, and she formed a board. 6 months went by, then another 6 months.
I guess after a year into it, the general partner of my firm said, so, are you coming back? And I said, well, just a little bit more. I just need a little bit more. I just need a little bit more. Well, it's been 3 years, and I lost the corner office. And that's okay. I didn't deserve it. I didn't deserve that real estate. This is a full-time job, and it's not a paying job. And we could use my income.
Yeah, Lisa Marie, what's your income right now?
Oh, God. That's embarrassing on the air. It's probably $20,000. I mean, I do a case a month at the most.
Lisa Marie says her husband's been 100% behind her.
As long as the power is still coming into the house, then this is not an issue. But if that happens, then we may have to revisit this.
The outcome of this work has been the launch of a group called FAIR, Fairness for Athletes in Retirement. Ken Belson says FAIR has a straightforward goal.
They're not asking for the annuities. They're not asking for the 401k plans, all the other things that the current generations of players get. They just want the same pension calculations that the current players get. That's all they want.
And here's where we get back to one significant piece of FAIR's strategy. Its primary focus is not getting NFL owners to simply give more money. Instead, it's focused on the players' union and getting the union to allocate more of the money for player benefits in the upcoming CBA to pre-93 pensions. That means reaching the players' union membership, current players.
I think there's a big responsibility on them to recognize the pioneers that helped them get
Absolutely.
The $90 million guaranteed contracts of where they are today.
FAIR plans to hire pension consultants who can present possible solutions to the players' union. The group has also been working with a PR firm and has released videos featuring the stories of pre-93 retirees, trying to raise awareness.
When I started in 1969, the average salary in the NFL, league-wide, was $25,000. Compare that to 2 million plus today, and it's a different world.
And Lisa Marie and John aren't going at this issue alone. Jane Arnett had stepped back from advocating around 2015.
When I heard from Lisa Marie, I thought, no, I'm, you know, there's no more beating that drum for me right now. And she asked if we could speak. And when we spoke and I heard how reasonable, how well thought out, and how professionally she was organizing this effort, I had to hear more. I had to listen.
Jane Arnett is now on FAIR's board of advisors, working with Lisa Marie Riggins.
I mean, I'm very clear on the fact that this is a baton race. And, you know, I'm at the very end.
72-year-old Elvin Bethay is also on the board. He plans on speaking out until he dies.
Whether it be another 5 years in front of me, but at least when I leave here, I'm going to say that at least I'll know I tried. We're not asking for the moon. Just a little more assistance.
Ken Belson of the New York Times says it's still too early to say what will happen. He says he hasn't seen any indication that current players will make retiree pensions a priority. But there's still time for FAIR to make its case. Lisa Marie Riggins is cautiously optimistic that current players will listen. And she knows there isn't much room for error for the pre-93 retirees.
This is their last shot. If we don't get on the agenda list and move some hearts and the stakeholders, then this will just be kind of a sad chapter.
That story was from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. In 1975, photographer Mike Mandel issued a series of baseball cards. Sort of.
I think I'm the only artist that ever had a project that was covered at the same time by Newsweek, Popular Photography, and Sports Illustrated.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
Stacia Shepherd thought she knew her dad. But then one day, a stranger called their home.
The phone is in my ear, and he's saying, "Your father's a crook. Did you know that?"
The story of a fallen hero and the mysterious obsession that drove him for decades. This week on Hidden Brain.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. USA Gymnastics, which recently declared bankruptcy, is reportedly trying to award $88,000 in holiday bonuses to employees. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Will Leach, New York Magazine contributing editor via Skype, and Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Welcome back to both of you.
Honored as always.
Hello, Karen.
So let's recap the last year in the life of USA Gymnastics. 204 women gave victim impact statements against team doctor Larry Nassar. Former CEO Steve Penny resigned. Then he was indicted. Then he was arrested for allegedly hiding documents related to the case. The U.S. Olympic Committee moved to decertify the organization. And that bankruptcy filing will most likely delay the lawsuits brought by women trying to hold the organization accountable. With all of this going on, it just seems completely tone deaf to pass out holiday bonuses. And I'm wondering, what is it going to take for the people at USA Gymnastics and in the Olympic system more broadly to understand the impact of what they've allowed to happen to the athletes in their care? All of this has increased calls for a union. Devorah Myers laid out the pros and cons in a Deadspin article this week. Is that what it's going to take? Craig, what do you think?
That wouldn't hurt. I can definitely say that. As for this bonus thing, I can definitely say, as a former lawyer myself, what would really be useful is attorneys for USA Gymnastics telling their client to stop doing stupid things like this. Yeah. It's not uncommon in a bankruptcy setting for someone to come in and say, "Hey, can we pay our executives $10 million in bonuses right now, even though we're closing all of our stores?" And it happens because the party asking for it is utterly clueless. It has no conception whatsoever of where it stands in the equities and in the eyes of the public. That's what's going on with USA Gymnastics. Liquidation and eradication of everyone involved in this organization is probably the only thing that is going to bring them to any bit of sense. But if it hasn't happened now, 2-3 years later, I don't know when it's going to happen.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Is these are still the same people, not entirely, but in largely the same people that created this whole mess in the first place. For me, I find it very difficult to be surprised that kind of craven, clueless people are still doing craven, clueless things. Short of them deciding, okay, the way that we're going to handle our bankruptcy case is to secede from the United States and declare war. Like, short of that, nothing would surprise me anymore with this organization.
What strikes me about all of this is right now we're really focused on USA Gymnastics, right? Because that's where Larry Nassar worked and that's where this particular thing happened. But there are problems with how the system is run throughout sort of the Olympics-related system. And it just happened to go down at USA Gymnastics. But I think if we were to really look into the system, we'd find that athletes are being abused and mistreated and the money is going to the wrong place in a lot of these organizations. And I think it might be time for athletes to figure out what they can do about it. Will, you're up.
Okay, so this week I was in Santa Clara, California, noted college football haven. You're by Facebook headquarters, which is funny. I found myself accidentally subverting democracy just by being that close to the headquarters. It just kind of snuck up on me. But anyway, so I was out there to cover the national championship game. It's a reminder of something that started to happen in college football. This is a big deal. I live in Athens, Georgia. This has been a big deal for the Georgia football team this year. There are more and more players saying, you know what? I'll play a couple games just so I can show you that I can play. But then I'm going to back off because you're not paying me for this. I'm just not going to do this at all. And I think right now it's just meaningless bowl games, but I can see it getting to a point where players are like, yeah, fine, I know this game is important to you, Lord Saban, but for me, I want to be able to make myself available for the draft, and I'm staying out of it. So I think it's a fascinating kind of thing that's happening in college football.
As college football becomes a bigger business, you cannot expect college football players to not eventually start treating it like a business itself. What I find is fascinating about it is the double standard that is applied, of course. I live in a very crazy college football town, and people will, in the same conversation, talk about how great it is that we just got a coach from another organization, and he broke his contract to come coach the Ohio State Buckeyes, and that's just smart business. And then the player says, I'm going to skip the bowl game because I want to save my future earning potential. Oh, that kid is disloyal, and he's terrible, and doesn't he understand what it's all about? If I'm a player, if I play college football, I do not care about those fans one bit. I'm going to do, if I have a pro career anyway, I am going to do exactly what these guys who are sitting out bowl games do. It is not worth the scholarship that they have given me to put my body and my future on the line.
Yeah, I can't help but think here of Kenny Willekes. He was the Big Ten Defensive Lineman of the Year. He started as a walk-on for Michigan State, and he was projected to go as high as the second round in this year's NFL draft. It was like one of those great feel-good stories until the Red Box Bowl, which the Red Box Bowl is a thing. He broke his left fibula, and if he were to enter the draft now, which he's not going to do, he'd likely to fall to later rounds, which would cost him literally millions of dollars. You know, if I was a player with any sort of NFL prospects, I think I'd sit in the stand for a bowl season and maybe a whole lot more than that.
Well, I don't know. First off, I think that you are very much underrating the sanctity of the Red Box.
I'm so sorry. It's a recent name change. I haven't gotten used to it yet.
There used to be a Blockbuster Bowl.
So no, I think, Craig, you really have the right note on that. Players are looking at this as a business because why shouldn't they? It obviously is. Fans are the only one that still have this illusion that this is about camaraderie and my alma mater and so on. It's no one considers that anymore. And unfortunately, because fans consider it more than a business, it's always the players who they always feel like are fungible and interchangeable. They're the ones that take the brunt of this.
Craig, please tell us the third story people should know.
Kyler Murray, the Heisman Trophy winning quarterback for the Oklahoma Sooners, has a serious choice to make in the next month or so. He was drafted in the first round by the Oakland Athletics of Major League Baseball last year and was given a $4.66 million signing bonus because he is a hot baseball prospect. He's very, very good, very, very fast, and is probably going to be a future center fielder in Major League Baseball. Winning that Heisman Trophy and playing for the Oklahoma Sooners, however, kind of created a bit of a wrinkle because now he is also looked at as a first-round draft choice in the NFL, and he has to decide if he's going to play football or baseball. Recently, it was reported that he is probably leaning towards football. Kind of surprising for people. He's only 5'9". A lot of people think he's not going to be a successful NFL quarterback. He's only guaranteed $4.66 million in baseball. He could obviously make a lot more if he makes the major leagues. If he's drafted in the top 10 of the NFL draft, which he may be, he might get a $20 or $30 million guarantee. But he also will face a life of degenerative brain disease if he gets banged up too much while playing football. So if I'm his dad, I probably tell him to go play baseball because he doesn't get broken. If I'm his agent, I tell him to go play football because he could probably make more money, at least in the next couple of years. But it's a pretty tough choice for the kid.
I find it fascinating that no one has once asked him, hey, Kyler, what sport do you like more?
Right.
Like, it's weird. I literally have just not heard that question once brought up at all. I think that kind of speaks to how we talk about sports now, right? We talk about the idea of what's the right decision for you? We are all kind of our own business managers and general managers. For me, when I think of my youth and I think of the players that most excited me, it was, of course, Deion Sanders and Bo Jackson, even Brian Jordan. Like, no one even – well, heck, Michael Jordan. We'll just pretend he played both sports. You wonder, like, if Bo Jackson right now – like, Bo Jackson, one of the most incredible athletes of my lifetime, showed up right now, we would all be like, well, interesting. In the fourth year of his contract, he might not get the incentives that he needs. So maybe he should focus entirely. Like, no, let him be awesome in both. It's a shame that we don't even consider that a possibility now.
Well, I totally agree with you. What does Kyler Murray want? You know, like, we're all going around and around in the pros and the cons and the business and the deals and the head injuries. But I hope that he makes the right decision for him and his family and not the right decision for all of us pundits who think we know what we're talking about. That said, Murray does stand to make more money and have a longer, safer career in baseball. Baseball does seem to be the smart choice, the dad choice, right? What does it say, though, about baseball as an institution if he picks football instead, Craig?
I think it says that it has a PR problem as far as appealing to young athletes who have choices. Baseball's not very glamorous. It never has been, but it's certainly not very glamorous compared to the NBA, compared to the NFL. It's just very hard to sell somebody who has options in football, in baseball, in basketball, other sports, to pick baseball.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Will Leach, contributing editor at New York Magazine, and Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
An honor. Thank you. Hi.
Mike Mandel grew up in Los Angeles. In 1958, at the age of 8, he became a diehard San Francisco Giants fan and an avid baseball card collector.
When I got to be, about 13, my father said, you got all these baseball cards. Why don't you just give them to the kid across the street who's, 10.
Mike Mandel regretted giving away his cards, but a decade later, he had moved on to a different passion. And that passion led to another set of really valuable baseball cards. Here's Only at Games' Gary Wallach.
Mike Mandel studied photography as an undergrad at Cal State Northridge. He graduated in 1972.
Photography at that point was at a very interesting moment where it was, at least the fine art world of photography, was confined to a pretty small group of people. I mean, there are people like Ansel Adams who were very well known, but not a lot of people around the world that were that well recognized.
For decades, photography had been widely seen as a utilitarian medium, best suited for journalism and portraiture, not as high art. But by the time Mandel earned his graduate degree from the San Francisco Art Institute, that perception was changing.
Around that period, the mid-70s, photographers started to become recognized. They started to become able to sell work through galleries and be collected by museums. And to make fun of that, I thought I would do a project, and that project was the baseball photographer trading cards. So that idea was to go around and make pictures of well-known photographers.
Mandel hoped to have the photographers pose as hitters, defensive players, whatever they wanted to do.
I had caps for all the teams. I had gloves, I had a bat, I had umpire's chest protector.
For the back of the card, Mandel would ask the photographers to fill out a questionnaire. It asked for their height, their weight,
their favorite camera, their favorite film, their favorite developer, their favorite photographer.
It was a fun idea. But Mandel was faced with a problem. How would he actually get photographers to play along?
First of all, I needed to make some prototypes that would enable me to get to the next step.
So in the summer of 1974, he turned to a photographer he knew, Imogen Cunningham. The 91-year-old was well known for her botanical photographs and industrial landscapes. She lived nearby.
I wanted her to choose to wear a baseball cap, but she already had it figured out. She was going to wear a Mao cap.
That's Mao, as in chairman.
And I said, well, can't we do the Cincinnati Reds? Will that work out? But no, he had to do the Mao cap.
Cunningham posed as a pitcher, her white hair and impish grin peeking out from under the brim.
And she actually had a very nice follow-through, and I like the picture a lot. I think it really shows her in a very high spirit.
In fact, Cunningham liked the idea so much that she did Mandel a big favor.
She was able to contact Ansel Adams, who was a good friend of hers, who lived down in Carmel, down under the Monterey Bay area.
Mandel says Adams, already a legendary landscape photographer and environmentalist, was more than amenable. But it took 3 months to get onto his calendar.
And it turned out that I underexposed everything because my flash wasn't synchronized. So I ruined all my negatives, and I was extremely humiliated and embarrassed because he had done a number of books about the technical aspects of photography, so to be someone who screwed up technically was pretty embarrassing.
Mandel called Adams to explain what happened. Adams just laughed. 3 months later, he had another appointment. He made sure to sync the flash.
And I had Ansel wear the catcher's mask and the chest protector. I thought the idea of a catcher you'd appreciate as the catcher of light. He looked a little funny with his catcher's mask on. He's got the ball in his hand. It looks like it might have been a kind of a typical baseball card.
Mandel's plan had worked. In the late summer of 1974, he and his photographer girlfriend, Allison Wolpert, set out on a cross-country road trip in his tiny Renault. 36 states and 14,000 miles later, Mandel had made portraits of 134 eminent photographers. In 1975, it was time to actually produce the sets.
The cards were done in the same methodology as the original baseball cards. So you would buy a pack of 10 cards that were packaged at random with a piece of bubblegum for a dollar.
Mandel had 400,000 cards printed.
I got about that many pieces of bubblegum donated by the Topps Chewing Gum Company. I think they just enjoyed the idea. I just had to pay for the shipping. That was it. The aroma of the gum sitting in my house was pretty intense.
When the cards were finally released in 1975, they garnered a lot of attention.
I think I'm the only artist that ever had a project that was covered at the same time by Newsweek, Popular Photography, and Sports Illustrated.
Museums exhibited the collection. Photographers threw card trading parties all over the country. Mandel was becoming a minor celebrity and meeting other photographers and artists.
And it gave me a lot of confidence in my ideas and going forward with other kinds of conceptual projects.
Like photo collections of obsolete motels, people in cars, and a middle-aged Santa Cruz housewife. He also created images for a series of 90 nonsensical billboards. Mandel's work over the next several decades would make him one of the most exhibited photographer artists in the country. When I first walked into Mike Mandel's living room, I almost accidentally sat on a white cardboard box on his couch. As we wrap up our conversation, Mike Mandel points to it. It's a complete set of baseball photographer trading cards.
Now, if you bought like a full carton of cards, like that carton that is sitting right next to you of the original cards, I think sells for like $15,000 on the art market.
Gee, I hope nobody put their Naomi Savage, Beaumont Newhall, and Bunny Yeager cards in their bicycle spokes.
That's Only at Games, Gary Wallach. A second edition of Mike Mandel's baseball photographer trading cards are included in a 2015 collection called Good 70s. Topps isn't making real bubble gum anymore, so the new cards have strips of pink styrofoam printed with the disclaimer, "This is not gum." Fiona Mutesi says back home in Uganda, most women don't get an education.
It's like a caste. You know, like, your family will never make it.
Just ahead on Only a Game, how chess changed Fiona's life. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here. And on the next How I Built This, how two women with no background in fitness set up some stationary bikes, dimmed the lights, boosted the music, and created a cult following and a multi-million dollar business called SoulCycle. You can find How I Built This wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, a visit with a high school football team that was at the center of Hurricane Florence. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's sports news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen. And before we start, I'd like to thank a couple of WBUR supporters, Bob and Ellie, who were in Huntsville, Alabama, and got me, per my request, my actual begging and rather disgracing myself, a Rocket City Trash Pandas t-shirt, woo-hoo, which I will wear with pride.
I'm sure you will. I want to start by taking us back to this time last week when I declared that I'd be rooting for Clemson in the college football national championship, and you said,
I'm glad you found a team to root for. You're rooting for the team that's going to lose the game, however.
Would you like to revise your statement?
Yeah, you're rooting for the team that's going to win the game. See, I revised my statement. Yeah, that was something. You won't see a Nick Saban team get beat that badly for a long time to come. Trevor Lawrence, I mean, for a guy who looks like he should be playing for Rush, is really quite a remarkable player. He outplayed his Alabama counterpart all the way across the field, and it was really quite something to see.
A former University of Oregon offensive lineman has sued the NCAA, the university, and his former coaches for, quote, serious lifelong injuries caused by squat drills. Doug Brenner was one of three players hospitalized with rhabdomyolysis, which can cause permanent kidney damage and even death. Does it sound like he has a case?
Yeah, it does. And I think it's really time, with this and the horrible event at the University of Maryland, it's time for the NCAA to start looking at what strength and conditioning coaches are doing.
According to the plaintiff's lawyer, the players were made to squat until someone vomited or fainted, and then the players left standing were, quote, punished with additional repetitions. Is this an institution of higher learning, or is this Hollywood?
Well, either that or it's Vlad the Impaler's School for the Remarkably Athletic. Again, this is the kind of thing that shouldn't happen. You are essentially making people exercise until they get sick, which is the body's way of telling you you've exercised too much.
Right. Eight head coaches were fired in the annual NFL coaching carousel this year. Five of them were black, leaving just two African-American coaches in the 32-team league. And if things go the way they look like they're going to go, all of those openings might go to white men. Are you among those who are concerned about this?
Yeah, I'm less concerned about the people losing their jobs because that's just the way it happens. That's the carousel. And while you're opening yourself up to diversity, it also means you're going to have more African-American coaches who get fired. The hiring of somebody like Cliff Kingsbury, who was 35 and 40 as a college coach, to run the Arizona Cardinals, that should get anybody's antennae quivering.
Yeah, well, he's never had a coaching position at any level in the NFL. He is known for working well with young quarterbacks, and the Cardinals do have a young quarterback in Josh Rosen. Is that at all enough to explain his hiring?
Well, that's enough to hire him as an offensive coordinator, but not a head coach, no. That's an embarrassing hire. It makes a joke out of the Rooney Rule. It's a big step back for what we thought was progress in this area.
New York Knicks big man Enes Kanter missed practice on Thursday due to an illness. So why is everyone focused on what he ate Wednesday afternoon?
Because he ate seven cheeseburgers. he does something called cheat days when he goes off his conditioning program, and he loves to, like, Instagram the food he's eating on his cheat days. Of course, he's also the guy that the Knicks had to leave at home when they went to London so he wouldn't be kidnapped and murdered by the Turkish Secret Service. So I think if the guy wants to eat seven cheeseburgers, they should leave him alone and let him do it.
But maybe he shouldn't put it on social media.
People see it. You're not just talking to, like, you know, your friends.
There's a new track team in town, or I should say in the city-state. Would you like to make the introductions?
Yeah, first of all, we all have seen pictures of the Swiss Guards who guard the Pope. And they wear the striped pantaloons and the old helmets, and they carry a pike. And the thing is, they're like Navy SEALs. They will kill you if they have to. So now the Vatican is launching a track team to go compete in international competitions. And why not, says I?
Well, it's not just Swiss guards. It's nuns and priests as well.
Yes, the team president, Monsignor Melchior Jose Sanchez de Toco y Alameda, who's team president and head of something I didn't know existed, which is the Vatican Sports Department, says he wants to see them at the Olympics. And I hope we do see him.
And finally, Charlie, the first rule of driving the medical cart must be don't drive over the guy you're going out there to treat, right?
Yes, the first rule of the Hippocratic Oath in medicine is do no harm. If you're driving the medical cart, don't run over the guy's foot before you get him on the stretcher. Apparently, he's healthy, you know, and he suffered no real damage from this incredible accident. But the video is terrific. And one of the announcers can't contain himself. He thinks it's the funniest damn thing he's ever seen.
Well, this happened in Brazil. And in pure soccer flopping fashion, the guy, like, rolls around in agony after getting run over by the cart. But then he runs back out onto the pitch before the game is over.
Of course he did. But the cart got a red card.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Okay, Karen didn't want us to tell you this, but it's her birthday this week.
And all she really wants for her birthday this year is more five-star reviews.
Your positive reviews will also help other listeners find Only a Game.
So go over to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you hear this show, and let the world know why you listen.
Happy birthday, Karen.
Happy birthday, Karen. Woohoo!
Fiona Mutesi grew up in a slum in Kampala, Uganda. She had to drop out of school when she was 6 years old. But then she discovered a talent that promised to turn everything around, not just for her, but for her family. Her story was so inspiring, Disney even made a movie about it. As Eilish O'Neill reports, things didn't turn out exactly the way everyone expected.
Here's the part of Fiona Mutesi's story you might know from the Disney movie, Queen of Katwe.
Two bags, please.
Your mother still owes me some money.
We'll make it up tomorrow, Sebo.
She grew up in Katwe, Kampala's largest slum. Her dad died when she was a toddler. Starting at a young age, she and her siblings had to sell maize on the street instead of going to school.
My life, like, it was just surviving.
Fiona and her siblings also had to do all the work around the house, the cooking, the cleaning. They hated it. So when it was time to do the chores, they'd go into a room in their house where they'd have a fist fight to see who had to do the work. Fiona says they had a name for that room.
We called it a war zone, so the person who lost had to do everything.
Fiona says those fights with her brothers shaped what happened next. When she was 9, she found out about a chess club in the neighborhood. If you learned how to play chess, you could get a free meal. At first, Fiona went for the food, but she started to get good at the game. One day, she beat everyone at the club except for one person, the player who at the time was the reigning champion. Fiona and the champion faced off. All the other kids gathered around the board to watch. Fiona remembers there being about 60 of them.
The other boys around, they were telling him, like, how can a girl beat you? You can't allow that.
The boy didn't allow Fiona to win, but she won nonetheless. Fiona says, after that, she didn't need to fight with fists anymore. She fought with knights, rooks, and pawns.
After winning this boy, I'm like, I can beat any other boy in the whole world. Back in Africa, the society, the way it trains us to be like, we women are nothing. Boys are the ones who go to school. The girls are supposed to be home. My grandmother did not go to school. My mother did not go to school. She got married when she was 16. The same thing happened to my sister. She also gave birth when she was 16. And actually, her first daughter, I just heard that she's pregnant. She's 17. It's like a curse. You know, like, your family will never make it.
But after the game where Fiona beat the club's chess champion, she felt like she might have a chance to break that curse by using chess. Fiona was shockingly good. She started going to bigger and bigger competitions, till by the time she was a teenager, she was representing Uganda at international tournaments. But the doubts would still creep in.
Whenever I went to these new places, like, I saw a lot of stuff and I was like, I wish I had this. And I didn't want to go back home always because I felt like right now I'm in this expensive hotel and I'm eating good food. At home, we have no food. I'm homeless. Like, I don't have anywhere. My life is not going to change. It will never be nothing.
But Fiona was wrong. Her life did start to change. She got a scholarship so she could go back to school. And she won enough tournaments that she attracted the attention of ESPN journalist Tim Cruthers, who wrote a book about her. Here's Cruthers talking about Fiona's chess prospects in an interview with Only a Game back in 2012.
She now has her foot on the ladder toward becoming a grandmaster. If she is able to gain a couple of more rungs on that ladder, she becomes a player who earns sponsorship. And so she can actually begin to subsist as a chess player. But that is her goal, to be able to get to a point where she can help take her mother, her sister, her two brothers out of Katwe and take them to a safer place to live. This is her one special gift. It gives her the opportunity to possibly rescue her family from the situation that is so dire at this point.
But it wasn't Fiona's one special gift that got her family out of the slum. It was her story. She got some money from Cruthers' book, enough to buy a house for her mom and to ensure that her family wouldn't have to worry about food anymore. But at the same time, she was starting to doubt whether chess really was a viable future.
When I was 17, like, I was winning a lot of tournaments, like I'd become a champion in Uganda.
The problem was, there are only really three big chess tournaments in Uganda every year. Those were the tournaments Fiona kept winning.
And it's like not a lot of money that's going to take you for the whole year until next year.
In 2016, Disney turned Cruthers' book into the movie Queen of Katwe.
She surrounds you until you have nowhere to go. And then squeezes you like a python.
Checkmate.
Such aggressiveness in a girl is quite a treasure.
but Fiona got no money at all from that. And she didn't feel her chest was as good as everyone else seemed to.
My name, like, went so high, and, like, my chest was still so low, like, you know. I wasn't even, like, the best chess champion, like, in Uganda. It was so hard.
Fiona says she tried hard to change that, to catch up to her name.
I was working hard, but, like, the more I worked hard, like, I couldn't find my name. My name is there, but, like, my chest is still here. Like, I'm working so hard on it. And, like, I felt like I was starting to forget about, like, myself, my family.
Fiona wasn't happy. She was starting to think chess wasn't what she wanted to do with the rest of her life. At one tournament, she hid from reporters to cry.
I felt like I was pushed, like, not because I wanted, but because of other people.
That's when her coach, Robert Katende, intervened. Here's the thing. Katende isn't a professional chess coach. By training, he's an engineer. He uses chess as a tool to mentor young people in the slums of Kampala. Fiona thought she might do better if she had a professional coach who could teach her the more complicated strategy she'd need to perform on the world stage. But Katende said,
"We don't have the money for the coach you want. I know there's people expecting you to do this, but what are you expecting yourself to be doing, like, in your life?"
Fiona thought about it, and she decided what she wanted for herself was an education, the education her grandmother, mother, and sister never had a chance to get. And it was chess that gave her the chance. At the Seattle premiere of Queen of Katwe, the president of a small Christian college, Northwest University, offered Fiona a scholarship. That's how Fiona ended up in the Seattle suburb of Kirkland. It has not been easy. When Fiona arrived for college in the fall of 2017, she didn't know how to type or use a computer.
I remember, like, in the first week, they gave us an assignment of just, like, 2 pages, and I had to type it. I spent, like, 4 days typing. It was so hard for me. Like, people are finishing within, like, 10 minutes, and I'm just doing this for 4 days.
And then there's a thing almost everyone has to contend with when they go off to college: homesickness. Life in a sleepy Seattle suburb is very different from life in Kampala.
At home, in the whole area, you should be knowing each person, and everyone is responsible to each other. So I grew up in this community whereby if I'd done something somewhere, my mom would know. And before then, her knowing, like, I would be, like, punished by another parent somewhere. And it's okay. So it's like a community thing that is there. I never appreciated it until when I came here, and I'm like, everyone lives by themselves. Like, people don't care.
On top of all that, Fiona still has to worry about money. Her scholarship covers tuition, but not room and board and travel to and from Uganda. So Fiona works as a motivational speaker, traveling up and down the West Coast. She also receives money from donors. It's not much, but she gets by. With all that, Fiona barely has time for chess. Days go by when she doesn't even play. She doesn't mind, though. That's not why she came here.
I don't feel like I really have love for chess like the way I used to have. Because during that time, I felt like it was chess the only way I had to use in my life. But right now, I feel like there are a lot of stuff that I can do in my life. I feel chess has opened the door for me. I'm so happy that I've made it this far.
Academics may now be taking priority in Fiona's life, but she hasn't given up chess entirely. When she's at home,
we are old, but everyone doesn't want to do, like, dishes or cooking, so we decide with the game.
That story came to us from reporter Eilish O'Neill in Seattle. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Gibbon. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.